This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Christian Camargo. Today on the program, we are airing a talk given by Major Matt Cavanaugh, a non-resident fellow at the Modern War Institute at the United States Military Academy, West Point, and an active-duty U.S. Army strategist. The premise of his talk is that the Star Wars franchise is a good vehicle for understanding modern military conflict. He focuses on his new book, Strategy Strikes Back, How Star Wars Explains Modern Military Conflict, with roughly 30 authors and writers. Cavanaugh spoke at the Hinckley Institute of Politics earlier this year on March 28th. Here's Major Matt Cavanaugh.
I have to say first, before we even begin, I am an active duty Army officer. So I'm speaking on my own behalf, not representing the United States government, and to help make sure that that's reinforced, that's why I'm not wearing my uniform today. So all opinions are my own. To some extent, this book was born out of the fact that I had poor eyesight. When I was younger, I didn't even know I had bad eyesight. I reported to school. I went to school at West Point myself. And when I showed up, they gave me an eye test, and I learned that I had bad eyes, and I got new glasses. And a few years after that, I went to Iraq for the first time. And just so that I was prepared to be in a forward operating area in combat with good glasses, I went out and bought a $500 pair, the most expensive sort of Oakley-like but not Oakley glasses with these sort of little ridges on the inside that connected to my eyes almost like goggles. They looked terrible, but I thought they'd be super great. When I actually got there, though, all the dust and the sweat got in and would fog up the lenses. And then one night there was a mortar attack. I got up and had to leave where we were sleeping with just my rifle, and I left my glasses. I couldn't see. I knew that if I actually had to fire the weapon, I couldn't do so. So from that day on, it was like I was attached at the hip with my glasses. When I came back from my first tour in Iraq, I went and had laser eye surgery, but not the good kind. I had, there's LASIK where they sort of cut a little flap, open it up, do a little bit of laser work, put the flap back down, and you can see. It's like a miracle. The way that the U.S. Department of Defense does it is PRK. And they take the little tool that when you go to the dentist and they scrub your teeth, they use that little tool to scrub the teeth on your eye. So that instead of cutting the flap, they actually grind down on the lens, and then they do the laser. And then what happens is those what they've ground through grows back over the next month or so. But when it grows back, it's like your eyelid feels like sandpaper for the month afterwards. So it's incredibly frustrating. In all this, now I've got pretty decent eyesight. I learned through life how important the right lens is. How important it is to be able to see first and then to see things clearly. And that's actually, when you guys have a copy of the book that you're passing around, and just so you know, that's an advanced reader copy. It's got a few grammatical errors in it, but other than that, that's basically what the book is all about. That book to me is a lens. It's a new lens, a new way of seeing modern war and strategy. Military strategy. And so I'm just going to talk about three things today. How it was that we built that lens, how we built that book, why I think that lens is useful for you, what you can see through that lens, and then lastly, specifically, what Star Wars, what you can learn about modern war from Star Wars. So how the book came to be. I was actually, I taught at West Point for 3 years, and so I got very used to blank stares from cadets. What you find really quickly when you're trying to teach about strategy, you find that if the person that you're talking about strategy with doesn't have a common set of experiences and reference points, then it's almost impossible to talk about strategy. So, for example, if I'm speaking with a cadet and I'm trying to illuminate a lesson in strategy about the Iraq War or a war from deeper in history, and that cadet doesn't know that war very well, then the lesson is going to fail. I left that assignment and I served in Korea for a year. And the people that I worked with were Koreans. I was in a command where it was half American and half Korean. And they don't know about the American Civil War all that much. So it was very difficult for me professionally to relate to Korean military officers because they knew wars that I did not know, and I knew wars that they did not know. So it made it incredibly difficult to talk about strategy and have a professional discussion. And I run, and one morning, while I was running, I was listening to a podcast. And the podcast was a physics teacher talking about how he was able to excite and interest his students in physics by using the famous classic example of Yoda lifting the fighter off of the swamp planet of Dagobah, right? You've all seen this famous scene, or you're familiar with it. And he said, look, like, all my kids know that. They've seen that. They're interested in that. They're excited by it. They're electrified by it. And so he used that as a physics lesson. So he asked the students to figure out, using some assumptions, how much force it would take to lift that fighter off of Dagobah. So, you know, the Star Wars world is deep. So there's a website somewhere where you can actually find the gravitational pull of Dagobah. You can actually estimate the weight of that fighter. And so they actually found that it would take 19.2 kilowatts of force to lift the fighter off of the ground. And that's only to lift it for 3.5 seconds, because in the film, it only lifts for 3.5 seconds. And that's about the amount of power it takes to power one block's worth of homes, or the horsepower that you get out of, the little smart cars. The little electric smart cars that people tip over sometimes for fun, or that, one of those two things. And I said to myself, this is brilliant. This is something that, because when you teach, you don't want your teaching to get in the way of a student's learning. You need to get people interested and excited on their own, because really you can't do it. It's a relationship. It's not just one person broadcasting information. And so for me, it was this recognition that I could use Star Wars. Star Wars is a war. It's a big war. It's a long war. So some of you are familiar with Thucydides, the history of the Peloponnesian War. It's been credited and called the first history ever written. That lasted, Thucydides wrote about the war for 27 years. My estimate is that Star Wars has gone on for 65 years, and it's going to continue. It's going to continue on. So this is a big war with blockades, coups, armies, special forces or elite troops, an empire, rebels. There are features of this that you can see anywhere. You can find them right now in the real world. And so when this light bulb went off when I was in Korea, I left Korea in June of 2016. And when you leave a foreign country, when you're in the military nowadays, there's sort of an exit process. When you arrive there, they give you every shot you can imagine. You know, like, there's a process for bringing you in, and there's a process for sending you out. And so I was in kind of a lockdown in pretty much the worst hotel room you can imagine. Greasy sheets, you name it. Not much entertainment in that room. And so 2 months earlier, in April a few months prior to that, all of the Star Wars films had been released on iTunes. So I splurged. I bought all of them. I've seen all of them before, but I rewatched all of them in order. Like I said, not much going on in my life at that moment. And so I started watching them and through a different lens, trying to understand the films as they relate to modern war, to real war. And that was for me a breakthrough point. Because at that point, I consolidated all of my ideas and then sent a message off to a couple of the other fellows that were affiliated with the Modern War Institute at West Point, the other writers that were there. So Max Brooks, who wrote World War Z, August Cole, who wrote a book called Ghost Fleet, that's a sort of a new version of Tom Clancy's books, and then some other writers that I really value and I think highly of. And they wrote back and said, this is a good idea, and we want to contribute. So instead of trying to write it myself, I asked a lot of people to join the team. So in that book, there's about 30 different soldiers, sailors, airmen, marines, generals, admirals. The former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO contributed a chapter, ambassadors, diplomats, people that have real experience today that are still serving and some retired, but that feel that there are lessons for real war in the Star Wars films. And this is actually kind of a Trojan horse. It's taking these movies that so many of us have seen, and it's an attempt to use these movies to get people interested in something that really matters in a democracy, which is fighting wars. In the end, I serve. You choose whether we fight. You choose where we fight. You choose elected leaders that do all these things. And so it matters to me a lot whether or not those choices are good. So this book, this is my attempt to help make it easier for people to want to learn about some of these subjects. So what can we learn from watching movies? What can we learn about real wars from watching films? Well, I'll tell you, I'll pass off like a few things that might be interesting to you. So if you look around the world at all the world's militaries, they have required reading lists for the people that serve in those militaries. And about 20% of the books on those reading lists are fiction. So for us in the military profession, we're already reading an awful lot of this. Why do we read this stuff? Part of it is escapism. So during the Second World War, while the Nazis were burning or destroying 100 million books, the American government was working with the publishing industry to send 120 million books to servicemen and women overseas. We believe in books. And it's escapism. There's one Marine that wrote to one of the authors in a book that he read. He was so motivated. He said, "This heart of mine turned over and became alive again when I read your book." When you are overseas in a dark, greasy, sheeted hotel room without your family, this matters to those of us. Fiction influences the way we think about war. John Steinbeck, one of his lesser-known books was called The Moon is Down. And during the Second World War, he published this book in 1942, and the book is an allegory about, it's effectively a how-to list, if you read it carefully, how to run an insurgency. And we translated the book into Norwegian, Dutch, French, the countries that were occupied by the Nazis, and we smuggled it into those countries. And we used that book as a method of helping those that were occupied resist against the Nazi regime. Harriet Beecher Stowe during the Civil War, the apocryphal quote, the little woman that started the Civil War by writing Uncle Tom's Cabin. Orson Welles, at the turn of the century, he wrote The War in the Air. People have heard of a lot of his other books, but The War in the Air was about what future war would be like when we had aircraft. And so in 1903, he wrote a book about what air power would mean on the battlefield two decades later and then in the Second World War. William Gibson, who coined the phrase cyber, Suzanne Collins, The Hunger Games, not many people know because she's sort of a recluse, frankly, as a writer. But her father taught at West Point, taught at the Army War College, and served in Vietnam. She wrote those books to help kids understand what it would be like to have parents that were fighting at war, because she experienced it when he fought in Vietnam. And then Rian Johnson, the writer and director of the most recent Star Wars movie, he said that he was influenced incredibly by the history of Rome and the fall of Rome. So there's sort of it's a two-way street. It's a window. Warriors influence writers of fiction. Fiction writers influence us and how we see war. And within the military, for so long, we've been heavily dependent upon two things to better understand our role in society: theory and history. So many of you have heard of the book The Art of War by Sun Tzu. It's been around quite some time. Just during the Song Dynasty, they wrote 43 different 1,000-page commentaries on The Art of War. We have mined theory. Since the American Civil War, there has been more than 70,000 books written on the conflict. That's more than one per day since the war ended. We have mined history to better understand military affairs. So that's why it's, in my opinion, time for a new lens. That's why we should look to fiction. We should look to books. We should look to media. We should look to film. We should look for other ways of better understanding this very important endeavor. And there's three things I think that we can get out of it. We can learn lessons about other people by watching films. So, for example, the movie Dunkirk. Dunkirk has replaced Saving Private Ryan as the most successful at the box office grossing war film of all time. That film is also a better way of understanding British military culture. I lived in New Zealand for 2 years. I went to graduate school there, which was fantastic. One of the most interesting things that I learned was that before I lived there, when they were shooting the Lord of the Rings films, Peter Jackson, the director, had a problem. He needed a mass of orcs. And so he went to the New Zealand Army. And the orcs in that film are the New Zealand Army. And what's interesting about that is that there's a scene in one of the films where the elves are marching. Well, the elves were real actors and the orcs were in the army. Take from that what you will. Soldiers were more like orcs and actors are way cooler. But the orcs in the Kiwi army, they taught the elves how to march in the film. That they were the ones. So there's photos from the set of the orcs teaching the elves how to march. That film represents the largest deployment of the Kiwi army since the Korean War. That gives you a sense for how large the Kiwi army is. That helps me, that nugget of knowledge helps me better understand an ally that I might have to fight with someday. The same thing applies to Chinese film and television right now. There is a mass of Chinese television being produced right now and has been for several years that is very anti-Japanese. That means something. The film that was the Chinese official selection to the Academy Awards in the international part of the competition, their official selection was a movie called Wolf Warrior 2, which is the highest grossing Chinese film of all time. And a wolf warrior in the People's Liberation Army, it's a special forces soldier. And the story is kind of a pretty classic shoot 'em up kind of a story. But what's interesting about it is that this Chinese wolf warrior, the story is that he goes to protect a group of Chinese citizens in Africa. And the bad guy is an American villain that is trying to sort of rape and pillage a fictional African country. And at the very end of the film, the climax is essentially the Chinese wolf warrior killing the American. The American is, as he's dying, spewing racial hatred at the Chinese wolf warrior, and then the wolf warrior kills him. And the takeaway from the film is very much a sort of not warm picture of the United States, but also displays the Chinese as heroic and powerful and global, which means something. And I'm not sort of picking on the Chinese, because if you look back at the Rocky movies, that says something about the United States. Or Leni Riefenstahl, the propagandist and film director for the Nazis, who, if you can go to YouTube and watch Triumph of the Will, if you want to have trouble sleeping at night. So you can use film to better understand other cultures. Sometimes it's simplistic. Sometimes it plays on stereotypes. But sometimes it can be effective, and it can help you better understand the world. It can help us with lessons about ourselves. There are an awful lot of military people in uniform, historically, that have looked to fiction as a rock and a companion. Alexander the Great carried a copy of the Iliad under his pillow wherever he campaigned. The Iliad, some of it is nonfiction, a lot of it is fictitious. It's somewhere in that gray space. General Grant was famous for having led a literary circle, a reading group, a book club, when he was at West Point and afterwards. He would read fiction to practice the imagination that would be very useful and meaningful to him in the future. David Petraeus, Stanley McChrystal, two more modern generals, have said that the French book, The Centurions, which is about a French unit, it's a fictitious look at the Vietnam experience for the French in the late 40s and early 50s, they used that as a guide for thinking through what it would be like to fight an insurgency. And James Stavridis, Admiral James Stavridis, the recently retired Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, has said that the collected works of Hemingway have been his most inspired store of knowledge as a senior military officer. Last, you can use fiction and film as a way of thinking through, what would I do? I get it. World War Z, the movie, the book is different. The movie, though, it's a lot of zombies running real fast at people. And it's kind of weird and scary, and yeah, it's fiction. I get it. But it forces you to think on some level what you would do in a modern pandemic that was moving, that was spreading fast. Some of the containment ideas that you see in the film may be applicable to the real world. There's a new series that's accessible on Netflix. I highly recommend it. It's a Norwegian show, and I'm from Minnesota and half Norwegian, so I plug the Norwegians every time I get the chance. But it's a Norwegian show called Occupied, and it's about what it would be like if in some future world where the United States has left NATO, what a Russian occupation of Norway would look like. And it's not all tanks and destroying buildings and bludgeoning the poor Norwegians to death. It's much subtler, much slower, and I think very realistic. It's subtitled, but it's fantastic. And for me, as a military professional, it makes me think about what are the signs and indicators, what are the things that, what would it actually really look like? There's other films that I could cite, but I'm sure you could too. There's movies that you've walked out of the theater, or you've turned off at the end of the program, and you've said, how would I have handled that? There's shows, long-running shows too, where you get some sense of the characters and you have a better understanding of how they might react.
That's Major Matt Kavanaugh. And you're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour here on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour here on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. On this program, as you might already know, we record and broadcast some engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. And today we're featuring a talk given by Major Matt Kavanaugh, which takes a look at his new book titled Strategy Strikes Back, How Star Wars Explains Modern Military Conflict. Here's Major Matt Kavanaugh.
Okay, so what about Star Wars? What can we learn from Star Wars? Now, like I said, there's 30 different writers, there's 30 different viewpoints in the book. So to me, this is sort of like a buffet, or it's like walking into an eyeglass store. There's 30 different lenses. I'm sure that a few of them you would enjoy. But a few of them, why send foreign aid? Why take our hard-earned money and send it to war-scarred soil? So Max Brooks, one of the co-writers, he looked at Endor and said, what was it like after the battle for the Ewoks? Would it look something like Afghanistan, where they fall into sort of a tribalism, which you can probably imagine might actually happen with Ewoks because they seem fairly tribal? But he makes the case for planet building as opposed to nation building. But his argument is a metaphor for why it matters that we solidify countries that we fought in, that we don't leave the country worse than when we arrived, which I know to some people seems like that's what we always do, but I wish it wasn't the case. The next one that I actually feel a very personal stake in, because I have a 6 and a 3-year-old daughter, Lieutenant Colonel Erica Iverson wrote an essay called From Princesses to Generals, Leia and the Evolution of Women as Warriors. So if you look at 1977, when the first movie came out, women had 6% of the script's lines. And at that same time, women were being recruited into the military, and they were told when they went to the rifle range, they actually received a letter that said, you're shooting not because you're going to be part of combat, but, quote, to give you confidence. But let's move forward 4 decades. 2015's film, The Force Awakens. We've seen a wholesale shift change of women to men. Princess Leia is General Leia. Grand Moff Tarkin, the big bad guy, is now Captain Phasma. We go from Yoda and Luke to Maz and Rey. And Rey is our principal character. So women's speaking roles went from 6% to 28%, which still ain't 50%. And there's an asterisk there too, because in that film, Rey had fewer lines than her male co-star, John Boyega. Thank you so much. Thank you. Today, women are in the infantry. Women are going to Ranger School. There is a woman 4-star general that is responsible for protecting the homeland, the United States, at U.S. Northern Command. And actually, I'm going into an assignment there in August. So women's roles have changed. We've seen this societal shift. And just this last year, for the first time, little girls are, it's been documented, the industry documents this sort of thing, princess costumes have been passed over by superhero costumes. So we are seeing a change in the strategic culture of the United States, a different way of seeing women. And you can see that same arc in the arc of the films. And so that's what that essay was about. Preemptive and preventative war. So there's the famous scene where Han shoots Greedo, right? So they're in the cantina in Mos Eisley. Han shoots the alien. And there's the over the course of the Star Wars films, they've re-edited that scene. And depending on which one you watch, Han either shoots him outright, cold-blooded, or they show Greedo, the alien, reaching for a gun first, and then Han shooting him afterwards. That differentiation matters. It matters because legally and morally speaking, a country cannot execute preventive war against a strategic threat. We are legally and morally only to wage war to preempt an imminent threat. So if you go from that scene, Han is in good graces if the bad guy raises his gun first. If the bad guy doesn't raise his gun first, then legally and morally, technically, Han shouldn't have pulled the trigger. That scene helps you understand North Korea. North Korea is a strategic threat, but is their gun up? Is the weapon on the pad? That distinction will matter. That distinction may matter a lot in the next 6 months or year. I hope that it doesn't. But just reading that chapter by another major, Chuck Biese, will help you understand if things turn about the way that nobody wants with North Korea. This will help you understand the distinction between preventive and preemptive war. Admiral Stavridis, the NATO commander, wrote, his topic was, I think, fantastic. How do you defeat a Death Star when you can't afford one yourself? It's a central problem of the films. If you don't have the money, how do you compete? And that has applicability in a lot of different ways. As a student, how do you succeed if you can't afford that Cadillac laptop? In business, as a startup, how do you succeed against Amazon? In politics, how do you succeed against a very well-funded, well-entrenched candidate? So this chapter, I think, is really applicable. And then my chapter, which I don't want to go into depth with. I'm going to go short. I had planned to talk about it. But it's about evaluating Yoda as a strategist. That's my job in the military. I hate that title because people hear the word strategist, it means everything and nothing. I might as well say magician. But when you get down to the core of it, my job is to be a senior staff officer and to anticipate, design, and facilitate security decisions for whomever I work for. And so my chapter was about looking at Yoda and evaluating how he did. And he didn't do very well. So I'll leave it at that. As a broader subject, you know, that I don't take films seriously, but I take strategy and military affairs and United States strategic affairs very seriously. So we're trying to make these films relatable and interesting, but it's in service to a higher goal, which is to help you, as citizens, make better decisions or better understand what those of us with short haircuts are doing. And one of the biggest lessons that I actually took out of the book and the films, and I wrote about in the epilogue, is that even in Star Wars, even in a movie, war demands death. People die. And it's a movie. And Jedi don't seem to mind dying because they show up anyways later and they hover, or they're robots or clones and you kind of don't care. But look at if you look back or think back on the characters that have passed away or died in the films, Han Solo most recently, Obi-Wan Kenobi, pretty much everybody in a couple of the films, that's a message that I think matters because it breaks us out of our potential to our inclination towards hubris, towards thinking we know better, because we don't. This is really hard stuff. It's very hard stuff. So, you know, Luke, to some extent in the films, when he was being trained as a Jedi, Luke was learning to see through a new lens. You remember that training scene in the very first film where he puts on goggles, and he's trying to knock the blaster, you know, the little blasts out of the sky. And Obi-Wan tells him, take it off. Use your Jedi sense, your Jedi lens. And when we get to the final scene in that film, that's what he does. He uses a sense that he has developed. I don't have that sense, and I don't think you do either. But I think that this book can be a guide. It can be a lens. We don't have the force, but we have strategy, and that's good enough, I think. So I hope you're interested in the book, and I would love to hear some questions. We should have some time remaining, and as long as you guys want to go. The book is it's out on May 1st. I should tell you that, too.
That's Major Matt Kavanaugh. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour here on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. Today we are airing a talk given earlier this year in March by Major Matt Kavanaugh. The premise of his talk is that the Star Wars franchise is a good vehicle for understanding modern military conflict. He writes about it in his new book, Strategy Strikes Back: How Star Wars Explains Modern Military Conflict. In this final segment, he takes questions from the audience.
Is there any movies or books that you would say are like very accurate towards like what it would actually be like to be like in the military, or any that you'd say are completely, totally just not even close?
Yeah, for starters, there's two pots of books, I think. There are an awful lot of gritty history books that are from the battlefield's perspective that give you a very tragic sense of what it's like to fight in a real war where the bodies are piling up. And E.B. Sledge's books about fighting in the Pacific, he wrote a number. You know, there's typically a couple that people recommend, but the stuff on his back catalog or B-side is very good too. So E.B. Sledge. Ernie Pyle was a reporter that followed along with troops in combat during the Second World War. And they've collected some of his dispatches from the front. And those are very unvarnished and fantastic. And interestingly enough, at Indiana University, they've collected his dispatches, his journalistic accounts, and they're really good. They're all online. And one of our writers actually took those and reimagined what it would be like to be Ernie Pyle, a war reporter, in the Battle of Hoth. So the rebels get waxed at Hoth, you know, in shorthand. And it's a great chapter. It's a really great chapter, and I love that chapter because we think war is bloodless, but it's not, and it won't be in the future. Someone's got to die. I hate to say it, but it's true. So.
Hi, thank you so much for your comments. I'm on faculty here and have used some pop culture for educational purposes, and
fantastic.
I'm completely on board with this and have done a teeny bit myself. As far as seeing cultures through the lens of public through of fiction, I wanted to throw out to you an example that I came across recently that you may know of. A woman who escaped North Korea with her mother when she was 13 years old. Do you know the story?
I'll say that I may not know the story specifically, but when you are serving in Korea, there's 28,000 folks that have crossed to the mm-hmm. south. And I have met and know of many of the stories, but please continue.
Well,
she escaped
through China with her mother, and she said the thing that inspired her was somebody got a hold of a copy of the Titanic movie. She watched the movie, and through that wondered, after having 13 years of a steady diet of propaganda films and government films, she just could not imagine a society that would spend a whole movie on something as mundane as a love story. And just that alone inspired her to leave. And so this idea of fiction teaching us about other cultures can operate in so many ways that we don't even know. So I would offer that as another example.
Yeah, and so to piggyback off of that, actually there's this famous story from the Iraq War, and it's a guy that I know that taught at West Point. He was a couple years older than me. But there was an insurgent in the community in which he was seeking to protect, and he was trying to get this person to put the weapon down. And one of the common frames of reference that they came to was this insurgent loved Titanic, had seen it 7 times, and cried every time that Jack slides off into the water. And actually, in North Korea, the one piece of American fiction that is supported by the government and propagated by the government is Gone with the Wind. They love that book because it sort of has a picture of an American... It paints America in not the most flattering light, but absolutely. North Koreans are so different, even from just South Koreans. Their language is different. So if you're in North Korea, they don't have a word for shopping. They don't have a word for, there's no cultural slang like develops in most of the rest of the world. And so that, I think, and hope, is the right way to deflate the regime. But I think that's too much of a hope, maybe.
First of all, as a Star Wars fan, thank you so much for being here. So
good.
I'm going to nerd out a little bit, if that's okay.
That's what I like to hear.
Okay, so you know, you've been talking a lot about how fiction can help us understand and represent issues related to the other. So like military conflict often has to, you know, it's directly having to do with foreign nations, other nations, external threats. But I think what's interesting is kind of, you know, as far as I have understood, you know, you're sworn to protect against threats both abroad and domestic.
Correct.
And there's an interesting narrative within, especially like if you look at the prequels, I know a lot of people slam the prequels for the execution, but I love the story, the narrative, that structure in the prequels. Mm-hmm. And there is this issue of domestic threats.
Yes.
To democracy, to institutions, and the Jedi as kind of what they see as enlightened warriors feel like, and there is a discussion, right, between Yoda and Mace Windu, especially in episode 3, what do we do when we have a leader corroding the institutions that are the democracy of our galaxy? Do we have the moral authority to be able to put a check on that internally, not just being, you know, subjugated to civilian control? So I guess my question is, there seems to be, I know it's not, I know we kind of like characterize it, maybe overstate it, but there is definitely something real happening between the civilian leadership that we have in the country and the institutions that we have. And I wonder what role, one, you know, Star Wars can be like a story, a narrative,
but it also has
lessons, right? Because, I mean, really, George Lucas is pulling from these real episodes in human history where democracy is eroded from the inside most of the times. So I don't know if you could speak to that.
No, absolutely. So to some extent, I have to be a little careful about this subject, but we have 2 or 3 chapters on that very subject. And you see it over the course of those first few films, which I completely agree, you know, I don't hate Jar Jar Binks like so many people do, but the structure of the stories are very realistic and they make a whole heck of a lot of sense. So the films depict a democracy that is rotting, but they also depict the Jedi who are sworn guardians and protectors of the universe, or the Republic. And there are moments where young Obi-Wan Kenobi makes casual phrases like politicians can never be trusted, and pretty soon his Padawan learner is saying, I prefer dictatorship over a democracy. In the military today, I literally got, last night I got back from a conference at West Point on this very subject, on civil-military relations. And civil-military relations is a very broad subject. It's both generals and how they relate to politicians and prime ministers, and soldiers and how they relate to Americans and civilians. And one part of that that we are very worried about is the fact that we are becoming so small. We are not in a conscription era. We are segregated and separated from society for the most part. I don't live where you live. It's not by anybody's choice or fault. It's just cheaper to put military folks on big bases in the middle of nowhere. Although I live in Colorado Springs, it's not nowhere. I like it there. But the other thing is that the officer corps, over time, whereas we used to be a completely nonpartisan institution, over time we have become more partisan, and we identify with political parties more than we did 40 years ago. Part of that is a natural consequence of the fact that people that join the military happen to have natural attitudes that run in step with one of the political parties over the other. But what's really bad about that is that it gives one political party the belief that they're the military party and the other political party the belief that they're not. And it's something that I can't stand, frankly. I'm worried about it. I don't think that you need to worry that tomorrow morning you'd wake up and there would be a coup. But I do worry that we are not meeting our professional obligation. And that's actually part of the reason why I'm standing here right now, because I don't have as many opportunities to spend time with people that are not in uniform as I'd like. And I think that's important. That's what the book is about. It's a chance to try and talk with more people. So, yeah, it matters in the book.
Hi. So my question is, in the movies, the Jedi are very much treated as kind of all-knowing and very, you know, nobody questions their decision-making.
Correct.
And in America, there seems to be kind of, a, you know, with the military being the most trusted institution in America right now, kind of how do we guard against getting into this mindset of the military knows what knows what's best, and any decision they make, we should just kind of agree with because they know.
You're absolutely right. Like the budget, for example, the president signed it, and when he said, I'm doing this for national security, the government must continue because the troops must be paid. We have become, in some ways, sacrosanct. You know, many other institutions, unfortunately, politics too, everybody loves their congressman, but they can't stand Congress, which is a tragedy. You know, it's something that we're worried, it worries me, because if I am free from constraint, if the military is free from any meaningful check, we're worse. We're better when real oversight is executed, when we are questioned, when we're provoked. And to some extent, in the modern era, most recently, we have not faced the scrutiny that I think we should. That's not to say that I think that, it depends on what you're talking about, but broadly speaking, we would do well if there was more oversight. And as it relates to the films, that's one of the things that one of our writers tackled, was that the Jedi were not questioned, and they should have been. Yoda should have been questioned. I mean, I hate to get passionate about something that is clearly, you know, we're talking about a guy that's that high in green. But he made his force around people that had a certain type of blood that was purported to be as rare as a virgin birth. And when they came to a real war, they could not fight that war. That's the classic line from Qui-Gon Jinn. I cannot fight a war for you. And that should be questioned. You either start becoming Match.com for midichlorian bearing blood people, or you start a second tier of maybe genetically less rare, but pretty good soldiers. Because what you do, if you refuse to make adequate preparations for conflict, and I understand, I lived in places where people believe domestic spending and butter should come before guns, I believe that for the most part too. But there is a minimum level of preparation that is required. And Yoda and the Jedi didn't make that. And that should have been questioned. I want to be questioned because it keeps me on my toes. It makes me better. You know, hottest forge sharpens the strongest steel is the phrase, right? I wish there was more of that. So you're dead on. A couple of chapters in there for you, I think.
Okay, so I was going to ask you before, why Yoda was a bad strategist or why you thought so. Because I have a friend who always talks about how much he hates Yoda. Nobody hates Yoda, but apparently you do too. And so I was just wondering, and you just kind of touched on it when you were answering his question, but I was wondering if there's anything else that he does that you could comment on that makes him a bad strategist or that he could have done differently,
so,
I guess.
Absolutely. There is this a myth of Yoda. It exists within the military. So people that go to our School for Advanced Military Studies, they're seen as Jedi, sort of like they've been trained by Yoda. And then there's a really famous defense intellectual named Andrew Marshall, who just retired. He ran the Office of Net Assessment within the Pentagon, and he's a brilliant guy. But his nickname was Yoda. And the intent with those nicknames is to confer sort of this sense of strategic legitimacy. But if you look closely at his performance as a strategist, it was terrible. So if we begin with the start of the very first film, Episode 1, the Republic ruled the galaxy and the Jedi defended the galaxy. Follow the story arc to the end of Episode 3, and the Republic fell, the Empire rose, and the Jedi were two heartbeats away from extinction. That is the arc. So you have to sort of step outside of that arc and ask, what caused that? And my argument is that Yoda, as the leader of the Jedi Council, was their principal and chief strategist. And then beyond that, whereas, like I mentioned at the beginning, I'm a staff officer, so I support senior officers' decisions. He was the senior member of that organization, and so he had responsibility for actually making decisions. And when I look back at those functions that a strategist should fill: anticipate, design, and facilitate security decisions. And then in Yoda's case, you make those decisions, you execute the decisions. All four of those he did very poorly at. In the interest of time, I'll only focus on one. So one of the major takeaways from the films is that Yoda and the Jedi, they do not look off into the future. It's a waste of time. But that's what the strategist does. You look off over the horizon. You see the requirements to come. Because if you don't, then you won't be prepared. And he wasn't. The Jedi were not. There's other pitfalls. He stumbled in other places too. But when you get down to it, that matters. That doesn't mean that you're always looking off at the top of a mountain and gazing into the sky. But if you're not looking to the future for your organization as a strategist, then no one is. And that's, to me, that's where his bloodiest cardinal sin was there. So there's more, but you got to read the book. Thank you. Thanks for coming.
That's Major Matt Kavanaugh. He spoke at the Hinckley Institute of Politics earlier this year on March 28th. You can find a full recording of his talk, which looks at how Star Wars explains modern military conflict, as well as other Hinckley forums, at our website, kcpw.org, or on the podcast version of the show. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Christian Camargo, your humble curator and producer of this program. Thank you for listening.